So my name is Paul Long. I'm with the Message Analyzer team. So how many of you have seen this presentation or heard of Message Analyzer before? Kind of curious. Okay, some of you, but not everyone. How many people are like Wireshark is their tool of choice when analyzing traffic? Okay, any Netmon users still in the room? Okay, all right, that's fine. I'm sure you guys will exist for quite a while. But this presentation is about Message Analyzer. And I've decided to kind of put it in the context of what can it do? I'm a Wireshark user. I want to know what it does. Where are the similar features? And what are some of the new things that it can do? It can do a lot of things, and I don't really have time to talk about every single feature, so I'm just sort of highlighting some of the things. How many people have seen the new version of Message Analyzer, the 1.3 version we just released a couple of weeks ago? Okay. One person. So we've changed the UI a bit, at least in terms of the ribbon and the main UI. So I wanted to discuss that. I wanted to discuss how to capture data, because maybe all you really want to do is capture it and look at it with Wireshark. We have some new tools to compare data, and I'm going to show you one of them. I'm going to just touch on decryption. I know Obey is going to do a more detailed talk about doing decryption. So I'm just going to touch on that, and then I'm going to talk about parsers and how to update parsers. And a lot of this is going to be demo. I'm going to try to use the trackpad since I don't have room for a mouse up here, but we'll see. So I think the first question that comes up is, how do I get my data? How do I capture the data? And this was, seems to be like one of the main things you want to do with any kind of tool, at least when you're starting out. So we tried to make this really easy. And so the way I'm going to get to this, answer this question, is I'm going to talk about our new start page, because what we decided to do is to centralize the most important things you do on the start page. And so to answer that question right off the bat is that you can just click the button that says Start Local Trace, and that'll do a network trace very similar to what Netmon or Wireshark does. It actually starts the trace right away. The only difference is that it captures on all interfaces at the same time. So you have multiple interfaces, it's going to capture them all at the same time. But some of the other interesting things on the start page are recent files. Of course, if you tend to work with the same data, opening up the same files, again, this makes it easy. It's right on the start page. Scenarios are ways of capturing data. So if you don't want a simple network trace, for instance, if you wanted to capture HTTPS traffic that's encrypted, we provide a method to do that with a scenario. And in this case, it's the pre-encryption for HTTPS. You can also open your data. You can open a single file or open multiple files together, and I'll show that in a second. And then we have links to our forums, which says discussion and voting, because you can vote as well as post new questions up there, and the blog. So these top five things kind of show up there. I probably should turn off my do not disturb. So this is just, and by the way, I put reference notes in the PowerPoint slide. A lot of this is going to be demo, but I think the PowerPoint slides will be one of these things you just go back to. I haven't posted it yet on the SharePoint site, but hopefully something I said, you'll say, I knew Paul said something. Hopefully the slides will help you give some reference of how I did what I did or what I'm talking about. So this capturing basics, I've already talked about that. You can start a local trace, and then it gets similar data like Netmon or Wireshark. But then the other thing that seems to come up is people don't want to use our tool. They want to use Wireshark, which is fine. That's the tool you're used to. Or maybe you're working on a Linux box, and you have no other choice. You can't run Message Analyzer on a Linux box. So we have this ability to export as a capture file. And I'll just show that real quick. Now I have to open the file. So you can file save as. And then the bottom says export. The only limitation here is Wireshark. Wireshark doesn't necessarily parse everything we can parse. And there's certain layers that we could capture, like certain wireless adapters, that they don't have dissectors for. But we take the data, and we, like, for instance, if you, how many people are familiar with ETL tracing, like using NetSH or Event Viewer to get a trace. So it writes files as an ETL, which you can't load in Wireshark, but you can load into Message Analyzer, export as CAP, and then read in Wireshark. So if you get some data that way, this is one way to be able to import the data back into Wireshark. But the limitation here is what Wireshark can parse, and there's some wireless metadata frames which they don't know about, and we filed bugs with them, but I'm not sure that it's high priority yet. And then finally, there's more capturing options. So capturing for the local network interface is just one possibility here. But we enable these things called scenarios, and scenarios are just a group of providers. It's a group of ETL providers put together in one, and these scenarios that we include in the product, in the box, allow you to capture, for instance, pre-encrypted HTTPS traffic. So if you're on a machine and you've got some HTTPS traffic that you want to capture, you can use this scenario to capture it. Now, it doesn't capture any of the wire traffic. It captures above HTTP. For SMB scenarios, if you're doing SMB direct or SMB encrypted data, if you capture it on the wire, it's useless to you, or you don't even see it because it's going directly using DMA or right through the network card. The scenarios that we've enabled here use the SMB client and server provider to capture the packets at SMB. So if you need to do just some troubleshooting there, this is one scenario that allows you to do that. So the question is, do you see TCP or anything else? Answer is no. You only see the SMB layer. That's basically, it's the provider itself taking the blob that it's about to send to TCP and dump it out in an ETL format. So you don't see the whole stack. Now, you could capture at TCP and or at the local network and the SMB at the same time and then try to correlate the data afterwards. That's actually possible. And then finally, there's custom scenarios. You can create your own scenarios, as complex or simple as you want, and save them. You get to this by new session live trace. And I'll only show this for a second, but not go into a lot of detail. So this is the new session button. And then you have different options. But if you do live trace, you could build your own scenario. Plus, you can see a set of all the scenarios we have. On the start page, we only list your favorites. And you can mark any of these your favorites. In fact, you do this by selecting the star next to the favorite. So for instance, if I want to be able to capture on a remote Windows server, which is a scenario we allow, you can capture on, you can be on one machine and capture remotely to a target server using Message Analyzer or the OS. This is not something we built, but it's built into the OS. But I can mark it as my favorite, and now it'll appear on the start page as well as the top of my list. So there's a lot more scenarios, and some of these mimic the NetSH tool, which is a tool that's built in the OS that captures more than just network traffic. They have these scenarios built in that allow you to capture the network traffic, the TCP stack traffic, AFD, a bunch of components together, because maybe you want to understand why a session was reset or more detail about what's going on the computer stack. And you can add your own providers to make up your own customization. So for instance, if you wanted to do something with Bluetooth, you could search the list of providers, which is really it's based on the OS you have, what gets exposed there. We allow you to select any of these and add them arbitrarily. It's really up to the component owner to decide what they log and how the logging works. So we just expose the list. And we create the scenarios that we know are useful, but you could always customize this yourself. And then as you see, now that I've marked that as a favorite, this remote network interface shows up in my list. All right. So any questions on capturing the data? All right. This is next question, and I forgot a question mark here, is how do I load and correlate data? So you've got your data somewhere on your disk, and you want to be able to load and maybe correlate two pieces of data. You have a trace and a text log, for instance. And so we allow you to merge multiple traces. And this is any kind of trace data, ETLs or traces, text log files are traces, .caps are traces, pcap files, all these things we allow you to load at the same time. And then you can also make adjustments for time differences. So I'm going to very quickly go over this demo, and I've done this a million times, but I think it's interesting, especially for this group. So I'm going to start a new session, and this time I'm going to start a file session, meaning I want to add lots of different files together. I can click the Add Files dialog, and I can select one or more. I've selected one. This is a PCAP file, which I got from a Linux box of some sort. So long ago now, I'm not sure actually where it came from. And now I have a Samba syslog that I've also copied. So this is a text log from a Linux box. When I add this, I have to specify what type of text log file it is. So we have this extensible system to be able to parse text logs, and we have hopefully the more popular ones built into the Message Analyzer. I have to tell it what type it is, so I say that it's a system, a Samba syslog. And then you'll notice I have other options here to narrow down the time range, to set a filter so they only load up a portion of the traffic. And of course, I could load many more files here at the same time. So now it loads the data, but the first thing we notice here, and I'm gonna talk about the UI in a second, but I'll just do this demo. Hopefully you won't get too confused, me jumping ahead. But I'm going to show you that the module is all the syslog. This is just a text log that got parsed. And then some point in time, and so I'm gonna use find message to look for the first thing that is not a Samba syslog. And so you see, whenever I type in a filter, it gives me some IntelliSense, so I can learn how to build filters, and there's other help there. I'm going to hit Control-Enter. That's how you apply a filter. I could use the, or find. That's how I find, and that's also how you apply. And so you notice that the first message it detected that was not a Samba syslog happens 4 hours later. Anybody know why that might be? Right, so with ETL files and CAP files and PCAP files, they know what time zone they are, and we correct for that when we load it up. Text file, we have no idea. It's not in the text file. It doesn't tell us. So you can adjust that yourself. The way you do that is you use your time shift in the toolbar. You select one of the files that I want to shift one way or the other. So I'll shift the Samba file, text log, and I'll shift it 3 hours. And then if I do this correctly, and this time I'll go find the first non-Samba syslog. And now if I page down a little bit, you'll see that, in fact you saw there, that now they're kind of intermixed. I've kind of corrected for this time shift. And you can do this on the hour, or you can do this like, a couple of microseconds if you have a log file that doesn't quite match up. So it's a little bit rudimentary. You can only, it doesn't, you know, if the things are shifting back and forth, you can't account for that. But if you got a little bit of shift or an hour shift, you account for that. And here are the slides in case you forget, as I'm sure, unless you're got a photographic memory, you'll forget. So I know how to use Netmon and Wireshark. How do I use Message Analyzer? And this is the section of the talk which I'm going to kind of describe our UI and kind of give you some tips for going back and forth and helping you learn Message Analyzer moving forward if you want to. So I'm going to start with some of the basics and the way the UI is arranged. And I've color-coded certain areas of the screen. The first one, the orange section, is the message data section. And in Wireshark, this is the largest window, same with Netmon. And in Message Analyzer, it's one of the larger windows. This is your data. But one of the differences with Message Analyzer and Wireshark is we can open up different documents together, different captures, two captures, and look at them side by side, or a capture and a text log side by side. You can also have multiple views of your data. So if you want one analysis grid filtered on SMB and another analysis grid filtered on HTTP, you can do that as well. So you'll see in this particular example, there's two. I hate walking around. I don't know if you can all see me. But basically, there's two tabs at the top, one for each file that I have open. Then in the blue area, blue shaded area, is Session Explorer, which is a window that kind of gives you a high-level view of all the things you have open. And then the green area represents these tool windows, we call them. They're basically, there's many of them. We've only displayed the ones by default that we think you need the most. But there's some others that I'm going to talk about in a second that you can open and will show up again once you open Message Analyzer. Now, the interesting thing about the green area is that they're contextual based on which visualizer or trace you have open. So, let's see if I can show you this rather than describing it. So, for instance, if I have a filter applied here, some filter, I'm not going to type in a real filter, but, and I go to the different window, the filter is contextual to the window. It's not filtering all the windows. That filter dialog is contextual. It's the same with all the windows below, these tool windows. When I click here, you'll see that the, let's focus on the detail area in the middle. In fact, I can use, rather than me walking around, oh man, it's gonna be hard to do without a mouse. All right, well, I'll just put a red line through the area. That in this detail window, it updates based on what I have selected. So if I change to a different capture file, the details is gonna change based on what is selected in that message. So I think people get a little bit confused sometimes because they don't realize the other areas are changing when you if you have two documents open. Does that make sense? Did I lose anybody there? Okay. And so by default, we show the following windows. And for the, let's see, let me make sure. So these are the areas. Some other things are that we've changed the, so we used to have a ribbon in 1.2. We decided that as we progressed, the ribbon had some limitations that didn't work for us. So we changed to a toolbar, which just has the popular commands that you'll use. Those are the ones that appear at the top. I'm going to figure out how to do this. Shift, mouse. All right, I won't do it. Hopefully you can see my mouse up here. But at the top are the buttons, and these are the most popular ones. These are fixed. You can't customize them in any way currently. But if there's something you want that you think should be up there, you could send us feedback and we can add it. And maybe in the future it will be customizable if we get so many requests that people want to be able to customize it. But all the other commands that were available are available through the menu at the top. So the menu has all the commands. The toolbar button just has the most common ones. And then, finally, per each visualizer, there's a row of buttons. So I've clumsily boxed those set of buttons. These are specific to the visualizer or the toolbar button. So if I had two windows open side by side, and so these windows can be dragged around. You'll see that there's a set of buttons or set a of it's so much easier with a mouse. Yeah. Of course, now it's each one has its own set of toolbars, and this toolbar can be different based on the visualizer. Right now, I only show an analysis grid, but there's other visualizers which I'll show you later. All right, so that was about just the general UI. Any questions about the general UI differences? Any concerns or feedback? All right, so now I'm going to focus on the grid, because in our grid, we do things differently than Netmon or Wireshark. And so the first thing you might or might not notice is we have these little cube icons next to each message. Currently, we only have two. We have a green one and a blue one. We had more originally, but we never... in fact, I think there are some other cases where they will show up. The blue one is something we call an operation, which is a combination of a request and response. And so one of our goals with Message Analyzer is to get rid of noise, to make it more concise. When you open up a big trace with thousands and thousands of frames, we want it to make it more concise if you're looking at HTTP traffic. Maybe you don't want to see all the frames. Maybe you do, and we can do that as well. But we focused on that higher application layer experience. So by combining the request and response, we can get rid of one line and make the summary kind of give you an idea of what's going on. Now, you might want to undo that, and I'll show you how to undo that in a second, or at least get rid of that option. Now, the other thing that happens is that we automatically reassemble all the data. So all those TCP fragments that you only see in a trace, like Wireshark or Netlon, disappear and kind of bubble up in the message itself. So the first thing you'll notice is that in the analysis grid next to each of these messages, that there's a plus sign there. And the plus sign just means, you know, you can expand it because you can see all the messages underneath it. The other view that we've now switched in 1.2 is we made this message stack view the default. And the reason I think it's helpful is because it gives you a visual of what happens. And you can see that the operation, this blue, consists of request and response boxes underneath it. And in fact, you can see on the right, even though there's no description, there's multiple boxes, which means there's been some fragmentation that's been reassembled for you that doesn't show in the messages. I mean, in the analysis grid by default. So another thing about analysis grid is we have this column called diagnosis. I didn't show it here, but I'm basically dragging, and then once you drag, you see this area which allows you to put it in different places. I'll put it in the middle just to redock it. And so there's this column here. Good thing I'm a piano player, because I don't think I could do this otherwise. You have this column called diagnosis. And then you'll see, in this case, a lot of blue icons. But basically, we generate a diagnosis of the information for you automatically. And this can be many different things. It can be a TCP retransmit. It could be some sort of error code. But what it can also be, which is important, is that it could indicate a validation diagnosis, which means that the protocol in the wire did something different than what the document specifies. So if you have a document implementation and you just open up a message analyzer, you could do something as simple as groups. I'm going to show this cool feature we have called grouping. I'm going to right click and choose group. There's also group by multiple values, but you rarely ever have to use that, so just use the top one. And what grouping does is it takes that column or that field, I'm going to collapse them all, and just groups them into the different types. So now I can see that most of them is other, meaning it doesn't have any diagnosis, but there are a few that have type 1, and I won't go into type 1, type 2, and the fact that it says 2 or 1 or I can't remember what the other one said, is maps, it's like an enum mapping to a type. But in this case, you can see that type 2 is a validation error. And if I click on the icon itself, it opens up the window inline in the grid and tells you what types of errors those are. There could be multiple errors combined together, which is what happened here. And so you can see that it said, the name field and type blah, blah, blah must be one of the type in pattern. So it's basically telling you that something was wrong with the protocol on the wire. Documentation specifies something completely different, you might be doing something wrong. So it might be a simple way to just validate your protocol.
It's against the documentation?
Yeah, against the Microsoft documentation. It's also what we decide to put in the parser itself or what to validate. We don't validate every single line, but we try to do the most important ones. If you have feedback, you say, this messes me up all the time. We can always update the parser to add those. But it's based on the protocol protocol information that's on TechNet. So now let's talk about hiding operation. This is something that I think a lot of Wireshark, Netmon users like to get rid of. It causes them a little bit of grief. The advantages of having operations, again, it makes it succinct. Another advantage is that it allows you to see how long it took for that operation to complete. So if you want to do some performance analysis, you could sort on that column. So in the analysis grid, I'll take off. And I could say I want to sort on time elapsed. So the time elapsed column tells you how long it took all the messages underneath, if there's more than one, to happen. And so if I click on the column, and I think it does it ascending first, so I'll make it descending, and then move back up to the top. It shows the things that took the longest on the top. So I can fairly quickly say, all right, this first HTTP operation took 2 seconds. Maybe that's a performance issue, I don't know.
That's the whole transaction?
Yes, from the very first message to the very last. Now there's also a way to get the server response time. There's a column, and so you can add columns. If I add column, it brings open this field chooser. Under, I have to remember where it is. There's a response time field, so I can add that as a column. I'll move it over. The response is a little bit different in that it indicates how long it took to get the first message back. So that gives you the server response performance characteristics. The response time gives you the complete characteristics of your network. So if your response time is high or close to the elapsed time, then your network's slow. If the network time is, if the response time is quick and the time elapsed is a lot larger, then you have a network issue. If they're very close, that means your server is just not responding very quickly, and that's where the bottleneck is. So it's a very simple way to get some performance characteristics about your trace. However, one thing you miss when you combine operations is you don't see how two operations interact with each other. You could have two responses and then two requests. Or you could have a response and a request. You don't know because the operations kind of hide that. So how do you get rid of that, the operations? And so the way you do that is using another tool window that does not show up by default. It's called the viewpoint window. And if you use 1.2, it used to be in the ribbon. And we moved it on you. We're sorry about that, but we're if this is really a button you need the most, then give us feedback and we'll make it a more discoverable option. But for now, you can go to Tools, Windows, and then Viewpoint. So under Tools, Windows are all the tools you have available to you. And like I said, we don't expose them all, but it's a way you can discover them. So I'm going to add the tool point, the viewpoint window, and you'll see that it opened up this window down here. And under operations, I have different choices. And we've also changed the way we've worded this, hopefully for the better. So by default, we show both operations and messages. We can show operations only, if those are the only things you're interested in, or only messages. And once I turn that on, and now I have to resort by timestamp. In fact, let me turn them off. Let me do this. I'm going to do a filter on SMB2, control enter. All right, so you can see all the operations. So I'm going to show only messages. And now you see the requests and responses separated out. And so this might be a little bit more natural for you, especially if you're just trying to do some comparison. Now, there's a caveat here, and it's only because we're hiding operations. We're not getting rid of them. So what does that mean? So what that means is that, I'm going to use a different example for this, and hopefully you guys can understand this. So I'm going to go back to here. So operations are turned on. And in fact, I think I have a slide leading up to this anyway, so let me get to it. So messages only will hide operations. However, being hidden means that filters still apply to the top level. And so now we have to kind of talk about this idea of top level. So like I mentioned before, you know, you have the plus on the side and you can drill into all the messages underneath. But this message at the top, we say this is the top level. This is the top layer of all the protocols, which is the operation. And when I apply a filter, it bases off the whole stack, the whole tree. So if I have, in this case, a request and a response, and I type in a filter, http.request, and I apply the filter, well, of course it's going to include the responses because it's tied into the operation. And it's only doing the filter based on that top level. Did I lose anybody there? Okay. Now, if I hide operations, all we're doing is hiding them. The filter acts exactly the same way. So now when I filter, even though my filter says only look for requests, it shows both the requests and the responses because the filtering is happening on the top layer. Does that make sense? Did I lose anybody? It's really just a side effect of how we try to get rid of the noise. And we try to get rid of the noise by turning everything into operations, but we don't change the way filtering works based on whether or not you have them hidden or not. We can change the filtering based on whether you have a viewpoint set. So I'm going to come back to this topic in just a second, but I just want to talk about filtering. So the first thing about filtering is you notice that in this picture there are 5 buttons, but in my picture there aren't, and it's because they're hidden, under this little tiny chevron. But if I open it up wide, you'll see most of the options. So this is only important is that we optimize the screen layout so you can at least see 3. You can see library, remove and apply on a specific screen resolution, but you might see less or more, and the buttons are still there, they're just hidden. And again, the filter changes based on which visualizer you have open. And then finally, there's no way to set a global filter, at least a view filter, on all your visualizers. Like if you have 2 analysis grids open and you want them to use the same filter, you have to copy and paste to each visualizer. We don't have a global filter option yet, though we think it's probably useful. And so this library dropdown that we tried to expose, but if it's not there, you could make it wider, is the way to learn, one good way to learn example. So in NetMom, we had this load, a different nomenclature for the same thing, but load allowed you to load all these built-in ones. But if you don't know how to do any filtering, this is a great place to explore. And I think one of the more popular ones is contains. If you just want to search for some text that you know is somewhere on the wire, you can just type contains, quotes and some text, and it'll go look for it. That's like the easiest filter to do if you know nothing about the data other than it's something that's part of the data. And you can, of course, do other examples like hex and case-sensitive and not case-sensitive. But the filter library is where you go to remember where that is. Okay, so this is what I was talking about, that filtering applies to the top level. So it's based on this tree of messages, and if any of the children of that tree matches, then the entire top level message is shown. A viewpoint is a way to affect the way that works. You can use it to change the layer you want to focus on, and then you can apply a filter specific to the viewpoint to see data at that layer. And so the way I'm going to do this is with the same example. I'm now, rather than showing the message only, I'm going to show them all, but I'm going to apply a viewpoint, and unfortunately this viewpoint is not in the default product. I don't know, maybe it should be. In fact, I'd like to understand from you guys. You know, maybe now with this knowledge, you can go back and try to tell me that, yeah, please, I need this. I use it all the time. But I have this viewpoint that I created called disable operations. So now, rather than just hiding them, I'm telling the runtime, the engine, they're not even there, please. And so now, when I apply a filter, if I apply a view filter, the view filter is always at the top level. And this is useful, for instance, if you want to apply a filter at HTTP and then drill into the TCP fragments, you don't want that filter to change. If you want a filter that applies to the viewpoint, we have this area below for the viewpoint filter. So I'm just going to copy it down here. So now that I've applied a viewpoint, and you can see here in the bottom, if I can get this to work. So it says that the viewpoint set is disabled operations. If I apply this filter, it applies the filter based on the viewpoint, so now I only see the requests. Does that make any sense? Okay. You probably have to play with it. I think, as you guys understand, we need your feedback to kind of make this more simple as we think through the product and we continue to evolve. I think there's things like this that we can make better, and getting your feedback on that could be helpful. All right, so that was it on the analysis grid part. Another thing that we've had for a long time are these things called properties, and properties are data based. It's not on the wire. It's not like how many people know that. I want to ask a question. In TCP, there is no length field. There is no length saying the payload is this big. It's just not there. The way it's calculated is you use the IP length and you subtract the two headers, the IP length header and the TCP header. So we expose this as a property because the payload length is kind of an interesting thing to know about if you see large payloads, small payloads. So we expose this as a property. But until now, you had no way to know that property was there. So what we've done is we've updated the details window, and this is the window that normally shows the details for the selected message. So I'm going to select on request. Let me just undo all the things I've done. So for TCP, the details window just shows all the data, but it's on the wire. This actually, every field in this detail window pertains to a field that's on the wire. The properties are now available to you by selecting the second mode in the details window. When you select that, you get to explore all the properties that are available to you. So there's a bunch of global properties that we keep. Every message has these global properties available to you. So maybe one that's a global is the summary itself is a property. The string, that summary string doesn't exist in the packet. We have to create it. And for every message, we create it. So it's a property that you can filter on. So I could say, right mouse click, summary. And I had this previous one. And so now it says, okay, we'll look for all the summary where that's, you know, the strings in there. I could say, now that I know it's called star summary, I could say, I don't want that, I just want contains. And complete the example, complete, but. So every summary that contains the word flags, maybe error would be a better example. I want to look at all the summaries where error is listed somewhere. But now with this properties window, it lets you explore those things. And so there's global properties, and I'll shrink that down just to get it out of the way. And then each message, in this case the TCP segment, is what we decided to call the message for TCP. Some protocols only have one message, TCP, IP, V4. But some, like SMB, have multiple different types of messages. SMB read, SMB create, each one of those are different message types. So for a TCP segment, you can see here that it has the payload length that I just discussed. And so again, you can right click. I could add that as a column, which will now expose the payload length for each of those messages. Payload length actually is defined in many places. TCP has a payload length. IP has a payload length that we've exposed as a property. So there might be multiple values. But the way the analysis grid works is that it propagates and shows you that the highest, the first value we find. So if there are multiple collisions in the tree, we only show you the first version. Another reason this is important, and this is the second part of this paragraph, is beware. The analysis grid bubbles up properties from lower layers. Just because you see a value in the analysis grid does not mean you're going to find it in the property window. And so I think a simple and good example of this is that source and destination are properties. There is no source. I mean, there is a source field, but it can be many different things. It could be the IP address, could be the source. The Ethernet could be the source. So we've exposed it as a property. But just because it shows up for TCP doesn't mean that it's going to show up in the TCP segment, because it's actually defined at IPv4. And here's this bug that I can't reproduce on demand, but it's not changing. I think I fixed this. That's annoying. In any case, if you could see, there's a bug here for, and I can't figure out how to reproduce it, but for some reason it's not updating now based on what I have select. But for IPv4, source is defined. But for TCP, it's not defined. The analysis grid is just saying, all right, where's the first place in this stack somewhere that you have source, and I'll bubble it up for you. And you can sort of see this, that for Ethernet, it's one thing, but for IPv4, it changes to a different thing, because the Ethernet source property is the Ethernet address, and then the IP source property is the IP address. Does that make sense? Okay. And so the next thing, I thought I had a slide. I didn't put it in here. Maybe I did. All right. So the next thing I was gonna post a question is, how about process tracking? How many people have seen Netmon and process tracking and know what that is? Some of you? So in Netmon, we had this ability to track traffic to the process that sent it. And this was kind of a useful way to filter based on the process ID. This information has always existed in ETL traces, but we never had a good way to expose it in Message Analyzer. Now, in Netmon, what we did is we used to poll the system and say, all right, what processes are loaded? We'll map that to the IP or the tuple, the IP address pair and the TCP port pair, and we'd manually build this table up. We didn't want to do that again. It actually has some other limitations, and I recently wrote a blog on this, but to answer that question, I'm going to go through these next couple slides. And so the first thing is we have this viewer. So we have these different visualizers. And we have this viewer called the grouping view. And this is analogous, if you're a Netmon user, analogous to the conversation tree. And so the way you open a viewer is you use the new viewer menu. So as you see, there's a list of all these different types of visualizers, different ways to view your data. But one of them is the grouping view, which I've set as a favorite. And this is a special view that opens up on the left side automatically. Because in Netmon, we had this idea of the conversation tree on one side and then the data on the other. And the way this works, this grouping viewer works, is that it allows you to define it the way it's grouped. In this case, these are two properties, network and transport. In fact, you can see that if I go look in the window, that this property transport is defined as this. So it's just a string that we kind of put the IP source and destination addresses together. And then network is a string that puts the IP address. And so you can use these buttons here, and I can collapse them all just to get a high-level view. You can see this consists of all the network conversations, and then for each one of these, there could be, I'll probably have to go to an IP. So for this one here, it's conversation between these two IP addresses. Shows that there's 31 messages involved in that. And then underneath that, I can see the separate TCP conversations that happen. And just like with Netmon, when you click on one of these, it filters every visualizer. I only have one, the analysis grid, and shows only that traffic. So now I've kind of narrowed down this whole trace and picked out one specific TCP conversation. I can choose reset and say, all right, undo that choice. I don't care about that. And show all the data again. Now it's not filtered. I'm going to go back to the slides. So this network and transport is arbitrary. It can be whatever you want. You can organize it by file name. Like, for instance, SMB files. You could have all the ones that pertaining to a specific SMB file and show that in the tree, or by anything else you come up with. So it's completely extensible. For instance, I could right-click on anything in here. I don't know what would be a good choice. But for instance, the connected state, I could right-click and say add as grouping, and now it'll add that as a separate grouping. You can also move these around or delete them. And then we also have a bunch of built-in layouts that you might rather use than create your own. For instance, we have one for file sharing, again, to arrange by the file name and the session, or the tree ID and the session, and then both file name. So that's the next part. So the question is, how about process name? And so, there's a trick, unfortunately. So, you can select process name and layout. So I'm going to do this. I'm going to do it on this trace. And I'm going to open up the grouping. And this is to also try to help drill in a point. So again, I have, you can see in Session Explorer here that I have two grouping trees. Got one here. And one here that's currently loading. And they've been tied in together over here. There's one here and one here. And in fact, there's these little colored bulbs to help you line them up if you have multiple sessions open. This is only, it gets more complex the more sessions you have open, because each session can have multiple visualizers. If you only have one session open, you don't have to worry about it. But that's what I've done here. And now I can choose this layout and choose process name and conversations. And so when I do that, it has to go through and reload the grouping again, since I've changed it. But once it's complete, you'll now see the process information that we've been missing for a while, that we didn't have the ability. Now, the thing that you'll notice once this is done is that it doesn't contain the icon. In Netmon, we used to show the little icon. We don't have a way to collect that data. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to collapse the top, all the groups down, just so you can see. And now you can see all the process names. And if I click on Internet Explorer, for instance, I should see a lot of HTTP traffic. So you can also right-click on the group tag and collapse them all. So now I can just see the process. I say this one looks like it sent a lot of data. Again, I can right-click and just collapse those. And then sooner or later, I can drill in and see, I should be able to see HTTP traffic in here somewhere. Yeah, so you can see some HTTP traffic from Internet Explorer. But there's a caveat. There's always a caveat. This traffic, the way we collect this traffic is we use data from the operating system itself. The operating system will log what processes start and what their ID is. It'll log these as events in your trace. The only way you can collect this data today is using either manually collecting the logs and combining it later with Message Analyzer. So you can collect these kernel, they're called Windows kernel trace logs. You can collect them and combine them with your data, and then we'll put them together. Or you can use NetSH, which automatically collects this trace data for you. So if you use a NetSH scenario, and I'll just, I didn't put it in the slides, but if you type NetSH start, no, sorry, NetSH trace start capture equal yes, then that'll include all this process data information for you automatically. Now, we don't have it built in natively in the message analyzer. We don't collect this data natively yet. It's not a normal provider. It's some old provider that existed a while ago. But you can collect it on the side. You can start a trace with message analyzer and then go to command prompt and either use NetSH or Logman is another way you can collect this data and then put it together later. I wrote a blog on this just last week or 2 weeks ago, I guess it was, that explains this all if you want to figure out how to use it. Hopefully moving forward we can integrate with Message Analyzer and then you can get a lot of the capability that we had before. There's another caveat, and this one's a little bit more subtle. The way this works is that the eventing system, what it does is it, whenever it gets a message, the eventing system looks in the local thread storage, it's just basically a field, and copies whatever thread that is, whatever process and thread ID that is, into the event structure. So if we go and dig down in this message, at the very bottom of every of these messages, there's an event header. I'll just click on this one, and hopefully it'll work. I think I have to, I'll just do it, tools. So at the bottom of these messages, I should be able to click. There's an event record, and in the event record in the header is where this process ID is. So when it records this event, it just goes to the thread local store and says, oh, this must be the process, I'm going to copy it. So you can imagine that on outgoing traffic, that's fine. It's probably the process that's in memory is the right process. So if you're the client and you send the HTTP message, it's going to be accurate. Problem is that if a message is coming in off the wire, it doesn't go find the process and load it into memory. That's not the way OSs work. They basically are multitasking. They just say, all right, here's the message. I'll go record it. I'm going to pull the process ID from whatever process is running and record it. So for incoming traffic, that process ID might not be accurate. In fact, it probably won't be accurate, and more than likely it'll be based on the most busiest process on your machine. Could be message analyzer if it's running and doing the capture. Now this is mitigated a little bit because with message analyzer we combine requests and responses. So if you're looking at outgoing client traffic, process ID, I'm going to boil it down for you, process ID is accurate. If you're on a server collecting traffic, process ID is not going to be accurate for the most part. So that's the state of the way this works. And I think that the way we'll fix this moving forward, or we can fix this, is by doing this at the firewall level with a different provider and capturing at a higher level when the process information is already known, rather than doing it at the kernel level where it's not known. Any questions on that? Yeah, that's so. What we did in Netmon is we used to do this, but we had to pull. So the question was, is that you can do this by using the tuple and mapping it to the process ID. There's an API call to say, get me the table, get me the full table. So it gives you this 2K table, and then you can go through and look through it. But the way we collected it is you have to kind of pull the table every second or so. You couldn't, it would change, you know, processes open, they might close. And then that polling is just putting overhead on the system. So we think it's better if the OS tells us what it is. And so we're working with the OS to implement this. But it's not something that we can do at the client level. All right, and then, so I think this is one also the questions that comes up all the time. Follow the stream. How do I see a message in this big chunk of data. How do I know all the other messages that are associated with it? Well, once you open up a grouping view of any type, you'll see here that in the toolbar, there's Find and Grouping Viewer. So now if I select a somewhat random message, from this list. Maybe I'll just look for HTTP traffic. So I see this one. I took off my filter just so I see all the mess of other stuff. And now I say find in grouping viewer. This now goes look in the current grouping viewer. It highlights it, and now it's showing only the messages related to that conversation on that thread, on that port. I mean, on that port, that IP address, that process ID, and that process name. So that's the kind of find in or follow the stream equivalent. And that requires that you have a grouping view open to use it. It'll be grayed out otherwise. All right, so this is one of these new tools that I wanted to show you, and I think this is it's kind of a cool feature that, I don't know, it seems like it should have been there all along. We've had it for a while, and we have these set of tools which we call preview tools, and this happens to be one of them. So you have to enable it. Whoops. So the way you enable it is using tools options in the UI. So you make sure you know where that is. Tools, options. And then one of the things here is features. And you turn on this compare window and then you restart message analyzer. And once you do that, in the tools window, you'll see a new tool called compare fields. The way it works is again, it's a tool window. You can move it wherever you want, but it just kind of appears here by default. You select the message that you want to select as the baseline. You right-click it and say set as baseline. And then any other message you select, it does a compare against it. So if you have two messages that you're wondering, well, what is the difference? I see it's working and it's not working. How do I tell what's the difference? This is kind of a very simple way of doing a message-level kind of comparison. So many people think that's a useful thing to have. Okay. Now, the other thing I'm going to throw out here, and I didn't have time to show it, and it's the reason it's a preview feature, other than some missing UI we need to make it better, is that it has this other portion of the feature that allows you to compare two sets of messages, like a WinDiff. And so you're welcome to play with this. It's not very easy to use, to be honest with you, and that's one reason it's a preview feature. But you can basically create two views, two analysis grids, filter down in each one, and then compare the two sets of messages together. But the trick, and I'll just explain this as quickly as I can, is that you have to set these options in such a way that it doesn't see a lot of noise. For instance, you know, the TCP IP sequence numbers are going to be different in two different, you know, sets of messages. And of course those are going to be different, but we don't want to see those as different. So you need to, like, include and exclude fields. But the easiest way to do this, and I haven't played with this in a while, is just look at the summary line. I think that's a pretty good indicator. And like, if you're going to do a WinDiff, that's probably what you would do. Maybe I'll write a blog on this. But again, if this is one of these features that you just think, if you guys implement that, you know, that would be great, let us know. I think it's something that, again, we have in our bag of tricks yet to develop, but we're just prioritizing features based on what you and everyone else needs. Now, I'm not even going to... I had a couple slides on this, but I understand Obed's going to go over this in a lot more detail, but I think the fact of the matter is you can decrypt TLS and SSL data with Message Analyzer as long as you have the private key. Instead, you could capture decrypted to begin with. That'd be one way to get around this problem altogether, is just use one of our other providers to capture the data. You know, if you have a scenario you can reproduce over and over again, and you know it's decrypted, we'll just capture it undecrypted to begin with, if you can. And that's using one of these built-in scenarios. But if you don't, we have this decryption tool that allows you to decrypt the TLS and SSL-based protocols. Can't decrypt all cipher suites. There's some limitations there. So you might have to change the server configuration to one that we do support. It's also dependent upon how the parsers are coded. So you might have a protocol that we've never encountered before. Usually pretty easy to fix or to extend, but we just have to know about them. And there's a decryption tool window, like the compare tool window, that gives you more information about it. But like I said, Obed's going to go through a more specific example, I believe. And in the slides, I have some of these slides that just kind of give you an idea. And then finally, where do I get additional parsers? So with message analyzer like Netmon, we have these sets of parsers, and it's extensible. And so we didn't include all the parsers in the box, but there are more available to you. The ones we have included in the box are, you know, like all the OS-based ones, a lot of the public-based protocols. But for Office, SharePoint, that kind of stuff, you actually have to install additional parsers. And so the slides go through it, but I'll just show you where this is done. So if you remember with 1.2, or maybe you don't, it used to be on the start page. We had this way of managing your assets so that you could load more parsers. We also had a way of getting more assets for, like, all our things in Message Analyzer are assets. Filters are assets. Some of these visualizers or charts are assets that you can load. And so parsers are also assets. So if you go to Tools, Asset Manager, in this list, you'll see a list of color-coded feeds. And for you, you only have one. I just happen to have three because I've created different feeds that people internally use. And these feeds, again, I use to push out filters and stuff to people that are working on projects. You can imagine using it for your team. Like, if you had 10 filters you wanted to share with your team, you could create a feed to do this. But the other thing we share through these feeds are the parser sets. And you can see in this list that there are a bunch of them, and they show up. There's a bunch of them that have this arrow, means that we're syncing them automatically. Anytime we make a change, we'll get an update. But there's a bunch of other ones that aren't synced. And so you'll see with the exchange parsers, I don't have these synced. You can click the arrow and say automatically sync the item. Basically will look for dependencies and automatically include those. And now when I restart Message Analyzer, you see that it says at the yellow bar that it's found some new parsers. I need to restart Message Analyzer. So I know in the past we've had a more in-depth presentation of videos available on this effect on the blog. There's a pointer to that video. But this is just the basics to know where to go to get this information, especially since it's changed since 1.3. And the last thing is, how do I give? So I've told you guys, you know, give us feedback. So how do you give us feedback? Well, there's at least three ways, maybe more. And we've added two new ways in the last couple of builds. And maybe you guys, have anyone seen this feedback or used the feedback? I'm kind of curious if anyone in this room has used the feedback. Thought that was okay. A lot of people have. I don't know. They don't have to give us our name, so a lot of it's anonymous. So the first, number one I have on this list is the feedback center. And this is kind of maybe centered around, I don't know if you've seen the Windows feedback that's similar. It has some scenarios. So once you use a feature, the icon at the top will turn yellow, and then you could come in here at some point and say, oh yeah, that was kind of cool, I'll give it 5 stars. So this is sort of a, you don't have to do it. No one, I mean, it's very easy to ignore, but it would be great if you guys could give us feedback about these things. We look through the feedback monthly, and it's invaluable. And it also tells us how to prioritize our features. So that's just one kind of systematic way to do it. The other one is a little bit more ad hoc. You can just send us a smile or a frown, and we tally those and kind of tells us what our level of satisfaction or dissatisfaction is. I think when you click it, you can also add in things. And a lot of people say, great, fabulous, or not so good, Wireshark's better. That's cool. That's fine if that's what you want to say. But it would be much more helpful if you could tell us why it's not helpful. Daniel, I don't know if he's still there, but yeah, we go through this feedback all the time, and it's like, great, great, fabulous, fabulous. You know, so it would be great to have as much information as possible. You can also participate by adding your email address, and that once you do that, we can actually, we'll send you an email, and if you opt in, we can contact you, and we are going to go through our list and contact people that have opted in Because we figure if you're going to give us your email address, maybe we'll talk to you. Maybe we do user studies and we do surveys. It'd be great to talk to you guys to get, because I think this audience is different than the our main audience or the other audience that uses protocol analysis. So you guys have specific needs that are different than the rest of the world. So this is another way to provide this feedback. And sending a bug report is the same thing. It opens up the same kind of dialogue. Now, the thing about sending a bug report is you're going to send a bug report and you think you can describe it in the details for enough for us to reproduce it, then it's okay to use this method. But I think a better way to give us feedback is through the forums. If you have a bug, I would just go through the forums and start up a new forum session, and then we can go back and forth. I don't know, 95% of this requires that I get a trace or some kind of steps, and we have to go back and forth. Unless you added your email address, that is. If you didn't add an email address, then we can't follow up. We get a lot of these bugs and crashes. We're like, okay, well, we can't reproduce it. It's not much we can do about it. So that's the last item here is you go to our forum. You can also vote on things on the forum. I don't know if it's very obvious to people, but you can, you know, upvote something if you do a search first and you see something, and I can sort on the top vote getters and find out, you know, if there's a feature people want, then maybe it'll get voted up to the top. Or if you're just having a problem, we monitor the forums. I usually do most of the monitoring myself. I was away last week, so if you put something up there and didn't get attention, that's probably why. So those are three ways to give us feedback. And so this is the last thing, and I just wanted to kind of bring it up with this group. We're looking for ways to help you guys. And we've had some, like, you know, people ask questions in the class and have requested things before. And these are a couple of things that come up in previous sessions in PlugFest. So maybe by a show of hands, I want to see, at least for the first two, if this is interesting to the entire group or anyone. So the first one is being, we can read SMB logs, but one thing that's come up before in the past is that people want to be able to, like, directly connect to their SMB server and pull the logs down into Message Analyzer. So they would have to be running on a Windows system. And by the way, before I start this, I think the number one request that we haven't been able to do is you want to run it natively on Linux and natively on Macs. And we haven't been able to do that yet. It's probably a bigger work item, but we understand that that's probably one of the main things. So this is about being able to load a log. You know, you're sitting on your Windows box and you're like, all right, I've got this problem. Let me go pull the logs from the Linux machine. Let me pull a trace in. Is that something, by show of hands, that people find useful? 1, 2, 3. Okay, 3 or 4 people. I'm sorry. Star unit. I don't know how to say the. Yeah, anything. I think that includes anything that's Unix-y, if that's a word. How about being able to? So, are you guys familiar with WinPCAP's ability to do remote capture? So how about that feature? If you could, from Message Analyzer, be able to remote capture from a Linux box. Okay, more. Interesting. Okay. And then any other ad hoc, like, thing that you want to throw out? Anybody have an idea? Oh, good question. So the question is there a command line version? And there's a PowerShell. We use PowerShell to be able to capture any of the scenarios that we showed in the UI can be done through PowerShell. And also you can, for instance, you could take a bunch of log files and stitch them together or break them apart via log file, via command scripts. What you can't do today is parse via the command line. So are you only interested in doing capture from command line? Is that? Okay, yeah, so he said equivalent to doing TSOC. So we can do that today. We can capture using PowerShell would be the solution there. And I don't have any slides on this. I do have a blog on it that you could read. The question is there auto completion on the scenario? So the auto completion for PowerShell, have you used PowerShell before? Yeah, so the scenarios aren't in PowerShell. You actually have to build your own scenarios. So would it be useful to do you want to be able to leverage the scenarios we have in the UI from PowerShell? Is that what you're asking? Okay. So many people would like to be able to I don't know if this is easily understood, but from PowerShell to be able to run one of our built-in scenarios. Does anyone? Okay. Yeah. Yeah, and I think one of the features we've been looking at is maybe what you're talking about is to be able to go in the UI and say, okay, I want to do all this, and then, okay, there's a PowerShell script, so I'm going to go run it, rather than trying to figure out how to use PowerShell. Okay, well, that's good. Yep. So do we have a Fiddler provider? Actually, the HTTPS inbox is Fiddler. In fact, when you run it, you have to install Fiddler, because we didn't ship the code, but it tells you to go install it. What we did in Windows 10 is we built in Box a Fiddler-like component, and it's there right now. If you're on the fast ring, at least, you can see HTTP Direct. And if you install Message Analyzer, I think there was a bug in Windows 10 at some point, but if you install Message Analyzer and it's worse, there's a new scenario called HTTPS Direct, I think. So, and that uses the WinINet component to log ETL events. But to answer your question, yes, we have a Fiddler provider. And we can open Fiddler files too, .sas files. So you can open them up and do all the same things. Okay, so the question is can you save, if you decrypt some traffic, can you save it in a decrypted format? As PCAP. Yeah. Right. So you can save it decrypted, but not as PCAP today. So today, yeah, I'm just going to tell everyone else. So if you got a decrypted packet and you know the key and you don't want to share the key with someone else, you can save it in our format and share it. You can't save it as a PCAP. Okay, so that's another. How many people would like to be able to do that? Interesting. That's very hard, by the way. it's like I think the Wireshark has to do something too, so I don't know how easy that is. So the question or the comment was about event-based capturing, and you mean stopping and starting a trace based on some event. So we support that already with PowerShell. You can say, you know, you can create triggers in PowerShell and say, when I see a message that matches a filter, start capturing. When I see another one, stop. When I see a third one, apply a filter. So there's a lot of flexibility. So we can do that. And PowerShell, do you think that solves your problem, or? So, you can send me mail, paul.lo@microsoft. I'm not sure. We have a blog. I'm not sure I talked about that. But you can also type help path. So when you use the PowerShell commandlets, you have to type update-help, and then that loads our online help. We have dynamic help that changes. So once you type that from a PowerShell command prompt, then you'll get the help, and you can type help space path, and you see the list of commandlets, and then you can say help on anyone. The examples, I've tried to make the examples pretty good, and there's a trigger in there that allows you to do that. So try it, and if you can't get it, let me know. Yes?
I don't know what the status is today, but making loading of other text file formats that aren't supported easier. So,
yeah. Right. Okay, so the question is an easier way to create, to extend our log parsing. And so we do support already TSV and CSV. Those open natively. As long as they're named TSV, .tsv, and .csv, they'll open natively. It's extensible today, but it's a regex kind of OPN. You got to write some code. So how many people would like a very easy way to create parsers for their logs files? Really good. Okay. How much for, I don't know how you guys can answer this question collectively. How many different types of log files? Do you think that every one of you has a different log file that you want to parse? Okay. It's an interesting question, right? Because I don't know. There's a bunch of built-in ones. But, all right, that's great. Because we were talking about this morning. I'm trying to figure out how important that is. So.
And the log files we want to parse would be custom to our system.
Okay.
The parse would be.
Yeah.
But still, just a text file, which is basically the regex work.
Yeah, no, I know it's some work, and it's, you know, it's not accessible today. So we talked about that. All right, any other?
Question about the scale and speed of capture.
Uh-huh. Yeah, so the question is about the performance and scalability of capturing and dropping messages. So I don't know if you guys are aware, but there's a, so we're doing better is the short answer. We don't have a way to tell you if you've lost messages, which kind of sucks. It's like you can do a capture and you're not sure it's going to be have drop messages in it, and so we have a feature to support that. We have a couple of bottlenecks in the system. One is the NIC. The NIC can drop cards. We don't report that. ETW system is the way we write our messages, and it can drop messages. We do have a way to report it, but we don't expose it through the UI yet. I think the ETW throughput, I can't remember, was like 300 meg per second or something like that. And there's always going to be a limit. I think there's, you know, you can always flood our system with more. There's a tool that Microsoft, company that Microsoft acquired, and is, what was the name of it? I can't remember. But now it's part of this ATA, attack something, I don't remember. Anyways, it's a tool that uses our engine to look at traffic live. Basically, they replaced Wireshark with our tool to capture the data live and analyze the traffic live, looking for security exploits by going all the way up the stack, potentially to LDAP and SMB. So it's able to capture live. It uses our API, which we haven't exposed publicly, but anyone can try to use it, and is able to do this live. And I think that their goal was, I can't remember, 50,000 messages per second or something like that. And either they're very close or we've achieved that goal because they're shipping this, or at least they have an open beta. So I think we're doing pretty good. But one of the things that we unlocked with them that Wireshark hasn't done yet is we're able to parallelize parsing. So now we can scale across multiple processes, which is something I've never heard of done before. In fact, it's been, you know, I think a research project for Wireshark for a long time. So it's something that Message Analyzer doesn't do now, but I think we've tested it with them on this live traffic, and is probably one of the things we'll push out in the next version of Message Analyzer. So, I don't know what. I guess it's just throughput, regardless of the NIC. So, 50,000 messages per second. And what, by the way, I say messages because it's more than just packets. But I think they wanted 50,000 packets per second. I don't know if it's 10 gig or 1 gig or whatever it is. They run as an appliance, so they have a machine sitting on the network that uses P mode to listen to other traffic. Yeah. What was it called? Arota. Yeah, Arota was the original company, Arota or something. I can't even pronounce their name. And they got, absorbed or whatever. We acquired them, and now they have this tool. It's part of the ATA framework. But anyways, they use our
integrated.
Yes, so which is kind of a cool thing to do, I think, and the parallel processing was the big win for them. All right, any other ideas from the folks in the crowd? All right, well, that was great. I mean, I hope I can remember all these. I should have wrote them down. I didn't think ahead there'd be so many great ideas, but we talked about a lot of these on our team, so it's great to have the feedback. I think that was my last slide. I have a resource slide in here. Basically, once you get the download, the start page has all the links, so you don't have to really memorize anything anymore. And then we also have documentation on TechNet that our writer Greg here works very hard to get to. And you can get the help, guidance, And there are scenarios in there, teaches you, you know, step by step how to do a capture, how to create a chart. I mean, a lot of information in there that's that could help you get unstuck if you are stuck. All right, well, that's it for me. Thanks, guys, for coming. Thanks for listening.